A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a variety of fascinating guests discussing the human side and impact of crime, not only on their lives, but mine as well. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, please contact Lifeline or any other support service or person that you feel comfortable with. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs and not everyone will agree with them. I understand that and I hope you do too. Thank you.
In 2022, I'm on holiday and I get a phone call out of the blue and they said, remember the bombing? I said, well, yeah. They said, well, you know, we charged him. I said, no. And they're like, yes, you know, like the trial's underway. It's already started. I've missed this completely because I've been up in Queensland. Nobody cares. It's a job from South Australia from 1994. Nobody in the Queensland media really had much interest. So they said, we'd like you to come back and give some evidence.
This week is part two and the final of my interview with Gordon Drake. And for those who missed it, allow me to recap who Gordon is. Gordon had a career spanning just over 36 years combined experience with both South Australia Police and Queensland Police, with an extensive forensic background, having attended a range of emergency incidents, examining major crime scenes, bombings, profile, serial killings, and a myriad of suspicious deaths, organised crime gangs, etc., until he turned 60. And then he had no choice but to retire. That's the rules in Queensland. No ifs, no buts, no maybes. You're 60, you're out of here. Last week, Gordon took us through his intimate involvement with the Snowtown murder investigation, an amazing investigation on just so many levels. This week, Gordon talks about his involvement in another high-profile investigation, and that is into the bombing of the National Crime Authority headquarters in South Australia, where a policeman lost his life and a solicitor who was sitting across the desk from that policeman lost an eye and had other really serious health issues until his death only about, I think, maybe 12 months ago. Gordon also talks about the intricate work involved in identifying the offender. It's incredible. Due to the bomb exploding on the 12th floor, obviously emergency service vehicles had flooded the area. And Gordon tells us of the painstaking work of picking out bits of glass and paper from the wheels of a fire truck that was parked under the window that exploded, and how all those tiny, minuscule pieces of evidence enabled or assisted in identifying the offender. It was just amazing. Gordon also talks this week about the day that he had a breakdown, but within maybe 10 days he was back at work and he never had another incident like it. But he tells of the importance of trusting the professionals and trying what they suggest, because that's why he was able to return to work. And of course, he had an understanding and supportive workplace and colleagues who just got it. They just got him and understood what he was going through, and he was able to open up and share how he felt and just how important that is. Anyway, look, have a great week. Enjoy this week and take care. Talk next week. See ya. Some of the jobs that you've been involved in, personally, I would think Snowtown would be that is up there. But also you were involved in the 1994 NCA, the National Crime Authority bombing at the South Australia Police Headquarters, weren't you? Which at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was one of the first really large-scale bombings that Australia had known. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I guess when you put it like that, I'm a bit of a, you don't say shit magnet.
I was just going to say, Gordon, yeah. Don't worry, I've been called the same thing.
I have been a little bit of a bit like that in my career, which in some ways has been good, but in other ways, of course, not so good. But yes, I certainly, because when I joined in the forensics in South Australia, it was quite a small group of us that were covering the whole state. So pretty much if it happened, you got involved at a major level. You would get involved because there was such a small group of us. There was only, I think, six of us when I started in the Adelaide office of the physical evidence. But, yeah, NCA, Geoffrey Bowen was a sergeant, I think, from the West Australian Police on secondment to the National Crime Authority at the time. They were investigating, the NCA was charged with investigating national coordinated crime across borders and those sorts of things. And he was in the office, 12th floor of their office in Adelaide, and he was having a morning coffee and discussion with one of the solicitors that worked for the NCA at the time. And the security guards come in with a package and said, "Hey, were you expecting a parcel?" He said, "Oh, no, I wasn't." He said, and the security guard apparently had said to him, "Hey, I've scanned it. It's come up." They had those wand scanners. And I believe the security guard had said to him, "Hey, I've scanned it. It's come up as something." But he said, "You know, I don't know." So then Jeff has sat there and he's just opened it. And as he's opened it up, Peter Wallace, it was the solicitor sitting across from his opposite side of his desk, and this thing's just exploded, bang, and it's literally sitting in Jeff Bowen's lap. So he had no chance, and Peter Wallace across the desk has lost an eye. It's blown the windows out, so the 12 floors of glass, it's showering across Weymouth Street in Adelaide. Pedestrians and people are running and wondering what's happened. There's a glass is literally raining down on them, and there's smoke issuing from high up in the building.
That's a hell of a bomb.
Oh, it was a hell of a bomb, yeah. I don't know now how big it was as such. I can't recall, but it was a substantial bomb. And largely a lot of red phosphorus was used, so it was bright, flash, bang, extra flashy, and red phosphorus stained the walls and the orangey red colour and that sort of stuff as it blew out. So, so that killed Jeff instantly. Peter Wallace lost his eye from it, was quite badly burnt, and so I had some disfigurement. He died only in the last 12 months, I think. Poor man passed away. But he survived long enough to know that the offender had been charged. He didn't live to the end of the trial, but he knew that he'd been charged and the trial was going to start. So at least he died knowing that the police had caught someone for it.
And who was the offender?
A fellow called Dominic Perret, who was an Italian man. He was, I believe, he was linked with the Australian mafia at that stage. And Jeff Bowen had been investigating him. In relation to a large cannabis crop in the Northern Territory. So he was, I don't know whether the NCA now, whether they covered Northern Territory from South Australia as well, but Jeff was in South Australia when this happened. So he was involved with Perret and some of his associates with this large drug crop in Northern Territory.
Okay.
And I think that was the motivation that Perret knew that the noose was tightening around him, and Jeff Bowen was the main instigator of it all. So if we get rid of Bowen, then are we right? That didn't work, of course, because as in policing, we have other people that can always pick up the file. So Dominic Perret got jailed eventually for that Northern Territory drug crop, I believe. So he did some time there, and we did a lot of work on it. I went to remember getting called out and. Late at night, I went to a farmhouse and found this enormous storage of guns and stuff under the floorboards of a horse shed, where all the feed shed and things like that. He had all these guns and books about bomb making and that sort of stuff all inside. So we photographed all of those and collected all that stuff. And so he was linked to those things. He had links to a gun shop in Adelaide as well that he was working but he would frequent there and talk to the owner of the shop about different various things, ammunition and buying bits and stuff. Most of the stuff, I think, was probably black market obtained. So all the work was done. Yep, we got the file together. We did the statements. Everything was ready to go. The court brief was put together, and eventually they said, we're not going to proceed. And I remember at the time, this is now, it's like 1994, so I've been in the police not 10 years.
Okay.
And I guess I'm a little naive at that stage. I'm thinking, that's not right. You cannot blow police up. You can't go around killing police and not face a trial. You know, we've done this stuff. We know he's done it. But they said to me at the time, they said, if we proceed with it and we lose, we don't get a second go because of the double jeopardy rules. So I said, you know, I understood that. So they said, we're going to wait until we've got a rock solid, a better case. And I thought, yeah, right, you know, pigs might fly. Nothing's going to happen there. So, and that sort of was as far as it went. I remained a little bit frustrated, I think, as did most of the police. But, you know, sometimes the DPP do know what they're talking about. And they said, no, we're going to sit there for a bit longer. So they sat on it. And they probably knew that Perry was going to get jailed for the Northern Territory thing. So he went to jail anyway for I don't know how many years, a number of years. And then out of the...
For the drugs?
Yeah, for the drugs. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yep. I think he may have done time in Northern Territory, I presume, because that's where the offence was.
Yep.
But
yep.
I believe he did some time for that. And then out of the blue, 2002, was it, I think? 2022, I'm in... 2022... I'm on holiday up at just outside Bundaberg. Harvey Bay. I was at Harvey Bay and on holiday for a week. And I get a phone call out of the blue and they said, remember the bombing? I said, well, yeah. They said, well, you know, we charged you.
In 1994.
Yeah, from 1994. And I said,
yeah.
Yeah. And I said, well, you know, we charged you. No. And they're like, yeah, it's, you know, like the trial's underway. It's already started. I've missed this completely because, you know, up in Queensland, nobody cares. It's a job from South Australia from 1994. Nobody in the Queensland media really had much interest.
Yeah.
So I didn't know. So they told me, yeah, we've got him. He got released from jail. We got some more stuff, some more DNA and bits and pieces. And the DPP have said, you know, we're going to go with it now. So they said, we'd like you to come back and give some evidence. I went, oh, okay. I said,
that is amazing.
They said, we found your notes. I went, really? They said, yeah, we got your notes. I said, we'll email them up to you or fax them up to you and that sort of thing. I don't know what email it was back then. And I said, okay.
Yeah.
And I said, well, when? And they said, can you come down to Adelaide next week? And I went, well, yes, I said, because I actually finish here. I check out here on the Saturday, I think it was. And I drove from Harvey Bay back to the Gold Coast. Found my suit, got my emails, checked the notes, and I think I was on a plane Sunday afternoon. Monday. Monday, I'm back. Because I had to ring my own boss here on the Gold Coast and say, hey, this weird thing's just happened to me. This is what's going on. And he went, okay. So he had to make a couple of phone calls, and I got approval from the bosses here to fly down to give evidence, which is just a formality, really. So I've left Harvey Bay on the Saturday morning, and I'm on a plane flying out of the Gold Coast on Monday morning to Adelaide. I've got to Adelaide just after lunch. Suit in hand, some rough notes, and they've picked me up from the airport and they've gone, oh, we're going to go, we'll drop you off your accommodation, but you might be appearing this afternoon. I go, oh, shit, okay. Nothing like time to prepare, read through your notes and get organised.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I said, I can't go just like I am. I've come down in, you know, casual Gold Coast clothes. I said, I need to put my suit on. So they took me to the hotel. I went up, the quickest change I've ever done, tied my tie probably sideways, backwards, I don't know, got back in the car, drove me around the corner of the Supreme Court and went up there and waited and waited and waited. And they went, you're not going to get on today, but we'll get you on tomorrow. Because I'm booked on a flight, booked on a return home flight on the Tuesday afternoon. So I said, okay. So anyway, they said, you won't get on today after all this. So I hung around till 5 o'clock. I mean, off we went, and that was it. So I went back the following morning, said, you'll get on tomorrow. So I got there in the morning and waited and waited. No. Lunchtime break. No. Still not on.
Oh, I don't miss that.
No, that's right. And I thought, oh, here we go. So I spent all of Tuesday, all bar about the last hour, I think, and they sort of rushed it on. I think in the end I had to get – they moved my flight to the following day because there was just not enough time for me to get in court, finish my evidence and things. So I stayed the second night, and I think I flew home on the Wednesday in the end. They moved my flight because I didn't get on until relatively late in the afternoon after the lunchtime break. So I got in the box and stayed there. And they said that the judge wasn't conscious that I had to fly home to the Gold Coast. So he extended the court. I think they stayed sitting until about 5 o'clock on the door, or 5:15 or something that night, just to get me fully heard so I didn't have to come back in the morning so I could get on the plane and get home the following day. Another 20
and how
hours
did you,
later.
How did you Wow. And how did you go in the box giving evidence? Like, did it all come back to you, or were you given a bit of a hard time, or how'd you go?
Well, it didn't be a hard time. It's one of those things where, because in some way, again, the way that these courts work, because I had so much time sitting around waiting, gave me plenty of time to get across my notes and talk to the other detectives and say, well, how did this come about, and get some background on it. And they even had all my negatives, because back then, we're talking just in the days we just had film. There was no digital cameras back in 94. Yeah. We weren't using them. So I just had all this big – they gave me this big folder full of envelope full of negatives. So I'm holding them up to the light and looking through some of them and refreshing my memory. And they've got hard copies of some of these photos, and they've got although I think most of the hard copy photos had been lost or destroyed by then, but they had photocopies of a lot of them and stuff. So I was given a booklet of photocopied black and white photos and stuff. So I was able to flick through. So by the time I got in the box, I was pretty much back to speed on it. And it's always a classic example when I said to some of the guys and girls I work with up here, it's one thing I was taught very early on, certainly in the forensic world, there is no substitute for good notes. And because I'd made, relatively good notes back in 1994, now these days people go, you write too much. You know, I think, no, you don't. Because somebody might have picked these notes up down the track when I'm not around and give my evidence for me. And I've done that for other people. You know, I've had to do that. And if they don't write enough notes, it's very hard. So I had good notes. So it all sort of came back pretty readily. And they didn't give me too much of a hard time, because really just about introducing the photos I'd taken of the guns and the booklets of how to make bombs and those sort of things, and that sort of circumstantial stuff that leads to it. But other people the bomb examiners had been in well before me and spoke about all the triggers and what the bomb consisted of and all those sorts of things. So
what did he get?
He got life and died only a month or so ago, I believe. He's pretty much been a lifetime criminal. He went to jail at the end of 2022. I think it was December, I think, by the time he actually got convicted. He was in custody the whole time, remanded in custody. But I think officially the sentence was handed down in 2022, and he died 6 months later in jail. In hospital, but he became unwell and they took him to hospital, so he died. But he died a prisoner. So, yeah.
Okay. Just going back, do you know how they identified him? Wasn't there something about this bloke was a bit of a dill, because didn't he put his address on the package, or wasn't it something as simple as that?
There was something about that rings a bell now. I think he may have put he may have even written a message on the back of it or something, some sort of veiled, maybe not a veiled threat, but possibly even like a clue or a hint. So whether he didn't expect the bomb to be opened, I don't know, but it's just how it went down. But there was some sort of personalising thing that left us to that, led to him.
But you were able, I believe, I've done a bit of research with this, and I believe that you were able to, with your forensic expertise, you were able to put together the sender's address label or something. It was along those lines. Am I right there?
Yes, I think there was some work was put together, because I remember the actual on the day of the bombing, even because the windows had been blown out, a lot of your evidence had potentially been blown out with that too. And when you're talking, as you probably know, when you're talking parcel bombs or any sort of bombing, very small things, you have like the interior parts of switches, little what seemed like just nothing to the average person, a little bit of brass or a little bit of silver metal might be significant. And I remember every fire truck that was trying to leave, because two or three fire trucks responded because there's an explosion within the city and a fire, potentially in a high-rise building. So they've rolled out a number of fire trucks, and before those fire trucks could leave, most of them had to have their tyres, the tyres were inspected make sure nothing was caught up in the tread of the truck tyre that might be relevant. So all these tiny bits were collected, bits of paper, bits of plastic envelope and stuff from within the building and outside as well, as much as we could find, to try and put that together. Then somebody would have sat down in the lab and a pair of tweezers and just tried to patch it all together.
It's painstaking work, that forensic work.
Why it's so frustrating when you get told, okay, you've done all this, that's all well and good, but now we're not going to charge you. We're like, what?
I bet. Not surprisingly, in 2009, I think you said, you described to me what I believe was like a meltdown. But and not surprisingly, as I said, but within a week or so, you'd got yourself back together and you've really never looked back. And I've got to say, Gordon, I really envy people like yourself who can be exposed to such horrific scenes and not be adversely affected like our lovely friend Bronwyn. You must have such a strong inner strength. But can you tell us or share with us what happened and how you were able to return to work? You've never fallen down again, because to me this is a positive story for those who have suffered a mental illness and they've lost hope of being able to return to what they loved, because you can, and you are testament to that.
Yeah, well, that's yeah. Thank you for saying those things. That's very kind. But yes, and that's true. I call it falling out of the tree, but had a meltdown. At the time, it was the scariest thing that ever happened to me. And I'm talking about, you know, being confronted with armed defenders and stuff in the early days as well. This really, really rattled me. I was on afternoon shift, so I'd left my home. I've driven my 12 kilometres to the office. I've gone into the office. Normal every day, nothing else is really going on around me. It's a regular sort of day. Go in, have a look at what jobs are waiting to be done. And then you sit there and you plan your shift. Who am I going to see first? Which is the best way to go? The shortest distance between different points. How am I going to order these jobs? And then I remember seeing a couple. I'd seen the night before, I think. And I said to the day shift, oh, these jobs didn't get done today. How come? And one of the guys, with no malice, nothing at all, just a throwaway comment that we would make dozens of times a week, he just said, because we knew you'd do it, Gordy. And that little sentence was what set me off. I thought, and it must have just been, I guess that's exactly how I was feeling at the time. I was being left with all these jobs, you know, that nobody else wanted to do. And it was just a straw that broke the camel's back. I started to cry. I got the shakes. And I thought, here I am in front of my workmates. I can't be seen like this. So I've then walked out of the office. I've got to my car in the car park, and I'm just crying like a baby. I have no control over this. I've just lost it. There's tears. I'm physically shaking. I thought, oh, what's happened to me? So I've driven home. Probably shouldn't have, but I thought, I've got to drive home. I can't be here. So I've got home, and then my boss has rung me at home. He said, well, I said, look, I don't know what's going on. I can't be there. And I explained briefly what had happened and started crying again. And he was, you know, going to touch base with me. So then I rang the doctor, my GPs, and they said, oh, we've got no vacancies. And I've broken down again. And this poor woman at the receptionist, bless her, she obviously realised there was something very wrong. She said, we'll come in. I said, I can't come and sit in your waiting room now. She said, come in, you come and wait, we'll find you a doctor. And I said, well, I can't. She said, we'll give you a separate room. So, okay, so I've driven down to the doctor's, honey. 5 kilometres away. I've gone in, I said, I'm here, and I've got my sunglasses on because I'm still crying. My eyes are crying. So she's put me into a little room, which was fine, and I'm coming and going from these emotional bursts. I'm still not sure what's happening to me. I'm thinking, what is going on here? And so I've gone in and I've seen the GP, a different GP, and he said, look, what's going on? I said, look, I can get some psychological support from work for free, and I can get that probably fairly quickly. So he said to me, okay, he said, I think you're having a bit of a breakdown. He said, you need to see someone. I said, I will only let you leave this office now if you promise me you will take this up with your work. And I said, I will do that. So by the time I got home, my boss had been in touch with the local HSO at the time, human support officer, who's a psychologist, and she's rung me, said, what's going on? I said, apparently this is what's happened. Okay, so we'll put you on the IDP program, intervention program. I said, okay. So within a couple of days, I was one of their nominated psychologists. He did some tests and things and asked me some questions. We had a bit of a chat over an hour or so. And he said, we're right. He said, straight up, he said, you've got PTSD. He said, you've got some mild.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Depression. He said, we need to do some work with you. Okay. That's not what I wanted to hear ideally, but at least it explained a few things that were going on. And so then I went back home, and they got reported back to the police, and I thought, this is it. My career could be finished. I've seen and heard these things happen before. You're done for. Yeah. I don't want that to happen. I don't want to leave my career. Weird as it is, I just wanted to stay on. So one of the other fellas had a similar episode months or a year before me, and he'd given me the details of his psychologist. And so I'd rung them and said, look, this is what's happened. I need to talk to someone. And she did a thing called EMDR, which I think stands for eye movement desensitization. That's it.
And reprogramming.
Yes. Yep. And it sounded like absolute hocus pocus bullshit.
I
thought, okay. And I remember my workmate had said the same thing, but he said, I did it anyway. He said, because, what have I got to lose? And I was with the same mindset. So I went down and saw her. I think I had a session with her. And then eventually, by the time the end of the week had come, I'd had 5 or 6 days off. Plus, I think there was a couple of other days off on there, like rostered days off anyway. So I think I only had 3 or 4 rostered shifts I was supposed to work before this happened. So I've gone back to work. I'm still feeling a bit delicate. The boss has been very supportive, and that was the important thing. And all my colleagues were going, hey, you're all right. I'm good. Yeah. But, I said, just really weird. And I started – I openly talk about this because – this can happen to anybody. I didn't think it would happen to me. You think you're bulletproof, and I'm 6'2", 2.5", nearly 6'3", 100 kilo of bloke. This stuff doesn't happen. This is this happens to girls. They're all emotional. So
not all.
It's the sort of thing you associate more with. The thing.
Of course you do.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. And I'm now a big fan. If there's any blokes listening to this, don't be afraid to cry, man. I cry more frequently since this happened. Whether it's because I'm permanently damaged, I don't know. It's probably, maybe I've just got to the use of the fact that now I accept that you can. Real men can cry, and not real men. It's okay. It's okay not to be okay. But because I had support from my colleagues and my bosses, I came back to work. I wasn't on night duties as such, but I think they were just a bit eggshell, walking around me for a little bit, just a bit careful.
Yeah.
The guy who made the comment, he said, "No, I'm really." I said, "Mate, it's not your fault. You probably could have said anything to me. You could have told me it was a can of spaghetti, and it would have just set me off." It was just that particular moment just happened to be. Nothing he did as such. It's just one of those things. It could have been anybody saying it. So I went back to work. I carried on, and I continued on with seeing the psychologist. So I think I had sessions, certainly fortnightly in the early days, a couple of those. And eventually she nutted down. She doesn't do EMDR straight up. I think we had 2 or 3 sessions, and she said, I think I know where we're going with this now. So she wants to do this EMDR. I went, oh, okay, here we go. Weave your hocus pocus on me. And it's like a hypnotism
that
type
airy
thing.
That airy, fairy, fluffy stuff.
Hit me up with this, come on. So she did it. I was crying again and bits and pieces happened. You leave there and you're mentally exhausted. And it only takes, literally takes probably less than 10 minutes from woe to go, the whole EMDR thing.
Yep.
This is not a long process. It's just a snapshot in time of the one-hour session you're having with your psychologist. So she's done this to me, and I've left there, and I'm thinking, I feel terrible. I'm worn out. I'm exhausted. I'm crying again. You know, this isn't working. And then 24 hours later, I've woken up, and I'm feeling so much better. And I thought, I think this has actually worked. So
I get that.
I think we had a few more sessions, and I think I may have had another EMDR thing later on. But I technically consider myself cured because of EMDR. And having a support network and stuff like that. So don't be afraid to when you do break, it doesn't have to be the end of the world. Don't be afraid to reach out for help. The service was very supportive, and I think most police services these days are. I think if it happened in South Australia early in my career, it would have been a different story. But we're talking 2020-odd now. It's we're into the 2022s and 3s. We're in a different era. People understand this much better. And I didn't want it to end my career. I was hell-bent. I didn't want it. I thought, if I have to move, where am I going to go? Where am I going to move within the police? But that was never even mentioned. They just said, well, if you want to stay, you can, but we need you to be well. So I sort of got well and stayed on there. And then it was – I've never looked back. It's been great. So,
but I think that another important message there is that – and you were probably getting to that, but – you still see a psych now, don't you?
Yeah, every once in a while. I'm probably about due. I think annually at 18 months thereabouts, just as a bit of a checkup. Because since this has happened to me, I remember I used to, like many people I know, we used to laugh at these American TV shows where everyone was seeing a therapist, their dog was seeing a therapist or whatnot. But I was seeing my therapist. It was simply like almost a running joke within a lot of American, certainly sitcoms and stuff. Oh, my therapist tells me this. I used to think that was a stupid thing to be doing. But I'm now a believer that we need to be doing checkups on ourselves, our mental health, just as we go to the doctor and we say, look, if we have a little sore, an injury on our arm or a leg, whatever we want, a visible injury, and it's not healing itself, we'll go to a doctor. We'll seek some professional advice. So what's going on here? But we don't seem to have the same attitude with our brain, with our emotional health. We might be feeling a little bit weird. I think, maybe I'm not traveling. Well, that's upset me a bit. Because what I did learn was that part of the reason that maybe I've had such a long career in this area is that I was also suffering from emotional numbing, which apparently is a recognized condition where I was putting my big boy shield up when I got to work because of all the things you see and you deal with, you get this emotional sort of separation. So you can function and not focus on too many emotional things. So there I was being very stoic and hard-faced, still with empathy, of course, but basically not letting these things affect me. But the problem with that is when you do it every day, all day, when you get home, you can fall into the trap of not letting that down. And that's where I'd got to. So I was being equally as sort of unemotional, detached at home as I was when I was at work. And that, I have no doubt, that contributed in some way to my breakdown of my first marriage. It made me probably less present and those sorts of things. There's a number of other issues that went on with that. And that's another thing that, I didn't see that coming either, being the divorce, just all the separation and things. But that's a whole nother story, and I won't bag my ex-wife over that. But it's I have to acknowledge, and people in our job, in policing, we see, even first response of any description, ambulance, fire brigade, all first responders, you will see, hear, and do things that no human necessarily should ever have to do. And see and smell and touch. And it's very hard. Allow yourself to accept that what you do is not normal in many, many respects, and it will affect you. If it doesn't affect you, there's probably something wrong with you. So when you start going to jobs and not getting affected, that's probably when you need to be talking to a psychologist and say, hey, I'm going to these jobs. I don't feel upset about this terrible tragedy. Maybe that means there's something wrong. Maybe it means you've got this hard shield up and you need to break it down. And don't let it continue on until it finally breaks you. But if it does break you, if you want to get better, I truly believe you can if you get the right help. And it's the secret is getting the right help.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, I've said many times that so many people that I know have been, let's say, to a psych or a doctor, and they feel like the doctor or the psych just don't get it. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, if you don't feel comfortable with them, you've just got to keep going, because when you find somebody that you feel gets it, it makes a whole world of difference, where you feel comfortable and you feel like, yeah, they understand you, because there's no point going to someone that you don't respect or you don't like, or you've just got to keep going. But I think the important part of what you're saying there, Gordon, is that you still, whether it be once a year or once every 2 years, it doesn't matter, but you still get, you know, you check in every now and then. And I know I heard a great story not all that long ago about a number of recruits out at the academy here in Victoria that are now, rather than wait until you and I, well, I fell over big time and you did, but you're able to get back. But rather than get to the point where, say, I got to where I couldn't come back, what the recruits are doing now is they are going to a psych before they fall over. So they are getting prepared, or as much as you can, for what we see and what we do. And as you said, what we touch, what we smell, you can't ever forget those, or you can't ignore them. They're always there. Mm. And so to get some help before all these incidents start building up, I think it's a great message. Mm. I really do.
Yeah, I'm pleased to hear that the recruits are doing that. That's a good thing. I think we need more people to be open and talk about this stuff. Men in particular are terrible at looking after ourselves. We don't look after our health the way we should. We don't talk about these things. Whereas I openly talk about stuff. Whilst I've had a great career, a long career, I've also had, you know, some health challenges. I had a brain tumor removed. I had some prostate work done, all fairly recent years. But I openly talk about that stuff to guys, and you think, and they go, oh, it's too much information. Oh, okay, I'll stop talking. But with blokes in particular, I say, well, you need to know about these things. And then after a few days later, you get a couple of them will come up individually and go, hey, when you're talking about that, you know, going to the toilet, you know, that weeing issue, how did that start? And before you know it, I'd gone and had this, you know, had a chat with a urologist and stuff, and openly told people I had a day off because I had to go and see this specialist. And then they were saying, who did you see? And then within about 3 or 4 days, at least two more blokes in the office have gone, I think I'm going to do the same thing because I'm starting to get some of those early symptoms. And they're a bit younger than me, but most of the guys I work with are sort of getting into their 50s. And I said, well, you need to go and do these things. So we have these open sort of discussions, and I think that's a good thing. We need more of that. And men of all, in all workplaces in particular, need to start talking about this stuff. You know, there's no shame in that. Girls, you ladies are talking about your bits quite freely and openly, as far as I understand it.
We do. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. We do. In fact, I always remember somebody saying, it might have been a friend of mine, Keith Banks. He's was an undercover cop. Mm-hmm. And he said, he's really jealous of the way women who hardly know one another can actually open up and talk about, I don't know, trouble with menstruating or problems with, I don't know, whatever it be. But he said he really envies the way women can be so open about their we're generalising here, but I think it's great that men are starting to be more comfortable, let's say, in talking about their emotions, because as you say, for some, you know, I mean, it goes back way back, that it was something that men didn't talk about because they, as you say, you had to put on that shield. You know, I'm the big strong man, I don't cry, I don't, you know.
Yeah. Real men don't cry and all those sort of rubbishy stories.
Real
men do cry when you need to, and you should. It's a good habit.
Yeah. Hey, Gordon, in closing up, I had so many questions to ask you, but oh my goodness, I don't want you to have to go to the psych tomorrow because I've bled you dry. But what I would like to finish on is putting Snowtown and the NCA bombing aside, if we could, what's the most challenging crime scene or emergency situation that you've been involved in?
Oh, wow. That's a good question, isn't it?
Thank you.
All of my scenes, they will vary, but probably the since I've been on the Gold Coast, some of the things you get here quite frequently, you work on a seaside suburb, so you've got tides coming up on beaches and things. And we had a job going back a couple of years ago now, a little baby, so a 9-month-old baby girl, was found washed up on the beach at just in Surfers Paradise one evening during Schoolies Week. So I was on night shift with one of my workmates. We normally work only as one up, but because of Schoolies, we always have two people working because we need to go in pairs because Schoolies all want to look over your shoulder. They want to know what you're doing. So one of us basically just runs crowd control and interference and can help get the job done a bit quicker. So we turned up on the beach with this 9-month-old baby. We thought, how is this 9-month-old baby just wearing a nappy turned up on the beach? You know, how's this happen? And we thought they wandered from a building or something. We think, well, it's old enough to wander from a building. And in the end, that turned out to be a murder. But I remember losing some sleep over that, thinking, where's this baby come from? And then they charged the fellow. It was New South Wales. I believe they found some CCTV footage that showed him throwing the child in Tweed Heads. And she's supposed to have drifted all the way up from Tweed Heads north up to Surfers Paradise.
How far is that?
Oh, that's got to be 20 k's probably in the water.
Oh, gee.
I looked at this poor little baby and I thought, there is no way the injuries and stuff, this child didn't look like she'd been in the water anywhere near that amount of days. I still, to this day, I still think it's more likely that they found that they were living, both the mother and the father were living rough, homeless people. And they had a little camp at Broadbeach. And I still think, given the nature of the injuries or lack of injuries and the general condition of the body, I think that she's more likely she's gone in the water at Broadbeach and drifted further up, only a kilometre or so further north, and then washed up there. But I can't argue if the New South Wales Police have got CCTV of him pushing her in. But it was really hard for me to get my head around that for a while, to think this child's supposed to have been in the water that length of time for a whole day, and it didn't strike me as having all the usual bits from drowning and tumblings and no fish activity and things like that you often get, which is probably good because of poor little kitty. But, that's a tough one.
I was going to say there's something, I say it a lot, but it's true. There's something, well, of course, but any job involving a little baby or a little child, anyone is terrible. But, kids, it tugs at your heartstrings and it's something you never, ever, ever forget.
No, that's right. I've got jobs on it. Another one that just springs to mind that it doesn't haunt me, but one I can still visualise going back before I even joined the police. And when I was a volunteer in the fire service, we used to do a lot of accident rescues and stuff. And I remember going out to the back of Gawler Belt in Adelaide and a car full of, a little red car it was, I want to say a Laser or thereabouts, had left the road, rolled onto its roof, and these people were trapped in there. And there's these young sort of teenagers, there's 17, 18, 16, 15. They're literally were dying in the arms of some of our firefighters. We had them inside the car and they're crying. A couple of them had died straight up. The car was, I think, almost overloaded. But, I mean, we were trying to right the car. We were trying to stabilise them. Ambulance people were coming. Some of them literally died in our arms. And you think, just such a waste of life. And, but it's... There's all the challenging scenes you get, I guess, in the police. All the good things that people should join for.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of the reasons that they're not joining anywhere. Policing.
I was going to say, I think we've put everyone off that was thinking of joining.
Recruiting didn't ring me up and say, you want to come and get a job with us. But all police services are struggling to recruit people, I think. maybe because these sorts of things that happen to us and the sorts of things we see and do are perhaps more commonly known now. And the average person says, well, this is it. You know, I don't want to do that. And, of course, you know, police have become punching bags a bit now. For that. There seems to be no respect for police anywhere.
No. Well, it's certainly dwindling. I mean, when, in my intro when I was talking about, and you and I have discussed this off air, like we couldn't deal with those, pardon me, but those smart asses driving past doing wheelies, and it's just like you watch them because you're not allowed to chase them, you know, for all sorts of reasons. And I just think I know policing has improved in a lot of ways, but I also think it's gone we don't have the respect that we did anymore, that we used to. But then I feel sometimes that that's in the community as well, that it's not just police that don't have respect. I think, you know, a lot of parents aren't respected by their kids, a lot of teachers, a lot of fire. It just goes on and on. Gordon, I've got to say thank you for – I just think to myself, what a waste that somebody like yourself isn't still, because of this ridiculous rule, like, and all that expertise, and you know, you're looking for employment. It just seems
I'm open to offers if anyone's listening or wants to give me a job. When I come back in 3 weeks' time from a holiday, I'll be looking for. I should be applying for jobs. In some way, so all of my knowledge and skills can go to whoever wants them. Yeah.
Oh, gee, I hope somebody's out there that that does give me a ring, because I'll put them on to you.
That's right. You can find me on LinkedIn as well. Anybody, and if there's any blokes out there who are listening who want to know about mental health, feel free to contact me. You know, we'll have a chat about that, or we'll have if your waterworks is not quite right and you're a bloke, give me a call. We can talk about those things too.
Oh, that's great. No, but thanks, you know, for what you've achieved in your career, for helping in convicting some people. Seriously, when I think about some of the horrendous crimes that you've assisted in, but it does all make us feel a little bit safer. For the sacrifices that you made in many ways. And, you know, again, the amount of police and emergency services that must go home and just be full of, you know, the grief they've seen and the trauma and the sadness. No wonder there's so many marriages that collapse. That's a huge load for anyone to deal with. But I do hope you have some time to smell the roses, and trust me, opportunities will come out of nowhere. And just take them, go with them. Because you never know where they'll lead. Someone with your expertise and knowledge won't be doing gardening or playing a few rounds of golf for very long, or good.
Thank you, Errol. It's very lovely. I hope you're right. I'm going to go and smell the roses and drink some wine in Margaret River soon. So 8 days, my wife tells me. She said, we've got 8 days before we leave.
I'm so jealous. Yeah. Oh, Margaret River, you know, just
I've never been, so the whole thing's going to be new to me. I've never been west of Ceduna, so the whole Western Australia experience will be new to me. So look out, Western Australia, we're coming.
Well, look, I'll just leave you with this, Gordon. When I was about 18, I started travelling around Australia in a combi with a couple of girlfriends. I had a combi and another girlfriend had a Hiace. And so, we just had a ball. Anyway, Margaret River has a very, very special place in my heart because we arrived at Margaret River and we met, there was five of us girls, and we met five guys travelling around Australia in a bus.
Right.
And I can tell you some of the best days of my life.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Anyway, I'll leave you with that.
I'm getting a visual of that already.
Thanks, Gordon. Great to chat.
Pleasure.
Have a good holiday.
Thank you very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.